I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. We've talked a lot about the Middle East for the last few weeks or a few months, and I thought it was about time we headed even further east to China and talked a little bit about them. Austin, you wrote an article recently. I know, Jim, you've been posting several. I mean, almost every other day we've got something happening in China, either new weapons developments or things going on internally in their government and like that. Jim, what's the current situation in China? What are they doing there in the South China Sea? And how is the rest of Asia reacting to it?
Well, the rest of Asia is pretty nervous. Recently, in the last few days, South Korea and Japan have finally made up and agreed to cooperate militarily. This is more in the face of a Chinese threat than a North Korean threat, although both exist. The Japanese see China as their biggest, danger. And the South Koreans, although technically they focus on North Korea, they also recognize that, China is the major threat long term. Chinese, on the other hand, are proceeding as planned. They have, as Austin pointed out in his column, they take a long view. They take into account the economic, angle in all of this. But they literally feel that in the long term, they are going to get all they want. And that's a classic Chinese strategy. They are already at war with us on the internet. We just had our government databases hacked, or at least found out about it. God knows what else we don't know about yet. The Chinese complained that we are hacking them, which is undoubtedly true. But of course, nobody openly admits that they're doing this sort of thing. It's an undeclared war, but I suppose we need a new term for this particular kind of war. The Chinese have been plundering our economic and military and government secrets in general, for over a decade. And we apparently are helpless to really stop it. At best, we can slow it down. Chinese are actually in worse shape, but we are more dependent on the internet than they are, although they're closing that gap. So I feel technically it's a standoff, mutually assured destruction, except unlike the Cold War, we are already destroying each other. I mean, we are literally causing damage. Although we have a lot of Chinese secrets, their secrets aren't worth a lot. Our secrets are worth a lot to them. And I've heard talk about, going after them on the economic front. That is, trying to sue them, for theft of intellectual property. But the Chinese have defended themselves against that as well. They don't try and market internationally stuff that is, indefensible in court, so to speak, that is stolen. But internally, a lot of their weapon systems, especially the ones they don't export, like their nuclear weapons, show signs of being based on American designs and undoubtedly American technical secrets. So the Chinese are at war and they're winning. It's just undeclared.
Austin?
Well, let me respond to what Jim said. I think he's got a very good grasp on what is going on at the moment. At one time, Dan, I toyed with calling this slow war, which is the term that I have used to describe a number of conflicts on the planet. Sometimes they're called frozen wars. That's, I think, more of a niche. But slow wars in the South China Sea, I toyed with calling it a phony war, the phony war between France, Great Britain, and Germany, after the fall of Poland, really wasn't phony. There was warfare going on in Europe, on the high seas, under the seas, in the air, but along the Franco-German border. Almost all was quiet on the Western Front. Not totally. There were things going on. The French had launched a limited offensive, and then withdrew, but that was what it was called, the Sitzkrieg, or the phony war, where all these other little and not so little battles for strategic position, and that would include what I'll call strategic psychological position, were being being waged. The analogy there. Here I'm. You're seeing why I do see some applicability to it. The analogy there is that what goes on with a information war and cyber has and cyber war has some relationship to what you would call a moral and psychological factors, but it also, as Jim pointed out, it has to the deals with the equipment and materiel factors as well. In the South China Sea, and look, I've written, in the last 13 or 14 months, I've written five or six columns on China in the South China Sea, looking at various aspects of it. Over the years, if you go back in the On Point archive, one of the first of my Creator Syndicate columns, that strategy page got when Credit Strategy Page started subscribing, was on China's boisterous borders in April of 2000 and 2001. And I don't know if you remember talking with me about that column, Dan, but you did, because you said, gee, a lot of people just don't pay attention as to what goes on all the way around China, all the bad relationships China has with its neighbors. And that's the old two-way street. Some of the reason the bad relationship there is because China's a bully. The other one is that China thinks it has all these threats, and there it's aggrieved, and now it's going to act to ensure that there is no chaos on its borders. But the South China Sea initiatives, if you go back and look beginning in the end of the 1980s, I know in my column I say mid-1990s for the actions in the Spratlys, but here's the historical root of it. And I did address this in another essay, at least glancingly. The Chinese put on what is now Fiery Cross, their base, Fiery Cross Island, the Fiery Cross Reef, they put up a weather observation post that was approved by the United Nations. China put up four or five of those, maybe a half dozen, late 80s, early 90s, in some of these disputed sea features. And that refers the listeners to the column, What is a Sea Feature? Well, a reef, rock, semi-submerged islet, and then that's not that's what the geographers call them. They're certainly not real islands. They're not even really islets necessarily. But it's a shallow spot that you could bring in a construction barge and put up a small weather monitoring station. Well, from that toe in the water, now you have a island with a 3,000 meter long air base capable of handling high performance aircraft and enough space on there to put some fairly robust surface-to-air missiles. That is from, let's date it, even though I know the weather station went up still sometime in the 1980s, but that's over the last 25 years, and the program really starts to pick up in the mid-1990s when you actually see China sparring with the Filipinos, Chinese and Filipinos, over some of these sea features and even islets now, in the same way China had sparred with Vietnam and just taken some disputed islands in the Paracels. Paracels are further north than the Spratlys, but the Spratlys are down in the, you know, like the middle of the South China Sea. And one of the some of the features that and areas that are in the most hotly disputed now are 200, 250 kilometers from Palawan, which is a major Filipino island, but there's still 1,500. They're around 1,500, 2,000 kilometers from what is regarded as legitimately regarded as Chinese territory. China is running in, runs smack in to the UN Law of the Sea treaty, which doesn't come into full effect until, I'm going to say, I'm doing this off the top of my head, but somebody can go check it out on Wikipedia. I'm going to say 1994, 95, but and then some of the elements of it aren't fully fledged until the 10, 15 years ago. But what that document did was put into an international agreement that several concepts that had almost commonly accepted as international law regarding economic EEZs, exclusive economic zones, how much space you've got going out away from your own shores for fishing rights, resource development, and the like. Put in place to try to limit disputes. And the Filipinos have a case up starting in 2013 to try to stop some of these things with China, but China just ignores the tribunal. It doesn't care. It's got, after all, it's got a UN veto, and it's bigger than the Philippines, and it's bigger than the Vietnamese. I suspect, and this is one of the things I said in my column, Dan, and this is a speculation, but China had been successful in these, keeping it largely bilateral, where they could bully the smaller fish. The big fish, a big fish takes a bite out of the territory of the smaller fish. They did this with the Vietnamese last year with the drilling rig incident in the Paracels, and boy, they really went to town in 2014 and improving Fiery Cross Reef. However, and they also thought, to some degree, they had managed the reaction through Southeast Asia, ASEAN, the Trading Confederation. They've even got an actor that's a member of that, Cambodia, that's kind of a quasi-ally. But the other members, Vietnam, Thailand, Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, the Philippines, all oppose what China's doing. I mean, and it's as the defense analyst Michael Metcalf, that I quoted in this week's column, calls it imperialism with Chinese characteristics. And as Jim has described, what that is, how clever they move when they have an opportunity and create economic assets inhabit these places with people. They bring in settlers, essentially, and now they're defending developed Chinese territory. But they managed, the Beijing managed to keep it where it was between China and the Philippines, China and the Vietnamese, China and ASEAN in disarray. The United States finally, it started last year, even though you go back and look at this, China had intimated on several occasions, I don't recall when the first one was, but intimated that you're going to have to check in with us when you move through our maritime zones. Well, okay, that's what you have to do when you come within what's called the 12-mile limit, and there are courtesy alerts when you move through near, you know, an offshore rig that's in an EEZ. But you know, the requirement is for permission, particularly warships. No, that's not the way it works. And then last year, China said, well, we're going to start requiring everybody to check in with us. And that impinges on freedom of navigation, which the United States regards as a vital interest, Dan. Freedom of the seas, freedom of commerce. We objected. And it came to a more vociferous objection end of last month. I noticed early on that there was some criticism of SecDef Ashton Carter's speech that he gave in Singapore right the last couple of days of May, but I went and read the whole thing, the transcript, and it was darn tough. It talked about how nations needed to make decisions, make some collective decisions, but free from coercion. And that was not directed at anybody else at that conference other than China. And I also talked about the importance of freedom of the seas. A Chinese general reacted to Carter's speech. I read a translation of the Chinese general speech maybe a week later. He was upset. I think China was surprised at what the U.S. immediately did, even though we said we were going to be doing it. The United States has had a bilateral defense treaty of some type with the Philippines since 1951, and certainly a relationship with the Philippines going back because, heck, it was American Commonwealth, American colony after the Spanish-American War. There have been discussions. The Vietnamese have all but said 20 years ago that they wanted some sort of strategic relationship, defense relationship with the United States. So Carter goes off to the Philippines and goes to Vietnam and signs some new defense cooperation agreements. They're very low level. Nevertheless, they're diplomatic diplomatic statements. And it's now what's happened. China succeeded in getting some, it's tough to call it facts on the ground, but facts in the sea. They've built these man-made islands. They're man-made islands. They're not, as far as I can tell yet, heavily fortified. I'm not sure how you could fortify them, but they are like, they're aircraft carriers. They are power projection platforms. They're where nothing was in many of these cases 5 years ago, certainly not 10 years ago. And it's when the Vietnamese and Filipinos accuse China of imperialism, territorial theft, they're believing their eyes. And the United States has, I said, if you read what Carter said, reacted strongly. Now, the thing is, talk is one thing. How do you back it up, especially with the decline we've had in U.S. Naval and air strength? I'll let Jim address that. We've had a decline, but we still got a lot of punch. So I'm not saying that war's coming. We can come around to that. But I think what I've tried to do is give a little bit of history of what the Chinese have been doing. By the way, that the cabbage strategy, which I mentioned, May 2013 is where I first encountered this. A Chinese general said that these new territories would be protected by leaves of naval, air, and garrison assets, like leaves of a cabbage, protecting something inside of it. So it's kind of a funny term, but the Chinese come up with great metaphors. So,
Jim, so what's happening with the arms development in China?
Well, they are basically trying to get past Russia, and they're pretty successful right now because the sanctions on Russia and the declining oil price has basically forced Russia, in order to get economic aid from China, to surrender basically all the remaining technology. Now, it's not just stuff that you can steal via the internet that the Chinese are interested in. What the Chinese want are the experience. They basically want Russians to show them their industrial secrets, how to actually make the stuff. It's one thing to have the plans, but being able to actually make it. For example, China's been trying for over a decade now to build Russian jet engines, or Chinese copies of saying, and they had a lot of problems. Of course, Russians had the same problems. Anybody who's gotten into the jet engine business has had to go through these trials and tribulations. And the Chinese realized, well, you know, if we get Russians to sell us parts of their factories and send people to show our people how to do it, then bingo, we've got engine technology. Russians have a lot of other technology which is similar, not all of it's military. So they have the Russians, courtesy of the Western sanctions, they have the Russians over a barrel, and they're looting them as quickly as they can. Once they have passed the Russians, they then will then come after the West. And they've been very deliberate. I mean, they've only been at this for about three decades now. Before that, they were lucky to be able to build passable clones of Russian equipment, often with Russian cooperation. But now they are just plugging along. And as Austin points out, they take the long view. They basically are expanding on all fronts, and the speed is not something they need. They just want to keep going because they know eventually they're going to reach all their goals. And like I say, that's a traditional Chinese strategy which has served them well in the past. Their big battle right now is internal. The Chinese Communist Party, the current emperor, as it were, is in increasing trouble with their own people because they're also going through another metamorphosis, and that is they're creating this huge middle class, not mention an upper class, you know, the industrialists, you know, basically business people, entrepreneurs who have made billions, and unlike the way the Russians did it by simply grabbing state-owned assets, these Chinese billionaires basically built something. And through their own, you know, enterprise and entrepreneurship, they have constructed some, you know, world-class industries, and they export it all over the world. The trouble is, the people who are running and creating these businesses are not happy with the way the Communist Party is running things. The Communist leadership, to their credit, are aware of this problem. The Chinese are also big students of history. That's something else that, especially in the United States, is not really paid sufficient attention to, because we tend to play down history. The Chinese sort of worship it. And the Chinese are right. I mean, they correctly assess the fact that for the last two centuries, through their own fault, largely, China has been, you know, eclipsed by the West. And their long-range plan is to regain their supremacy. Because what a lot of people, again, in the West especially, in the United States, are not aware that before the 18th century, the largest economy on the planet was, and had been for over 1,000 years, China. Now, this was a pre-industrial, you know, economy, but it was very efficient. They had a lot of people. They had a lot of entrepreneurial people. They had a merit-based civil service. Something, the Mandarin system, we call it, but they basically innovated with that. But they thought that they had it all, and they, what these Western barbarians were doing was, you know, nonsense and no need to pay attention to them. And they realized that was a big mistake and they're trying to make up for it. So they consider themselves successful if they can close that gap, that 200-year gap, as it were, in 50 years. Which is what a lot of their plans aim for. I mean, they're only 30 years in, but they feel in 20 years they will have caught up with the West. If the the communists hope to do this, but only if the Communist Party can stay in charge. Again, we have to keep in mind that Russia is still an empire. They still have an empire, an emperor, and he's called, you know, the head of the Communist Party. And it's basically still a communist police state, something another you know, technology the Russians perfected, as it were, early in the 20th century. But as the Russians discovered, it eventually falls apart if you don't keep it efficient. So the Chinese have economic problems, not just with the corruption, which they are really making it up to crack down on. They're sending some very senior people. We're talking Politburo. That's the highest committee, as it were, that selects the supreme leader and that basically runs the country. They are prosecuting Politburo members for corruption and basically putting the entire bureaucracy, and we're talking over 10 million people, on notice that either you clean up or you risk losing all your wealth and go to jail. Now that China's being practical about this, anybody who cooperates gets to keep up all or most of their stolen gold, their fortune, as it were. But they're running into a lot of resistance because China has always been corrupt. The military, most of all, again, that's something else the West tends to, you know, play down because especially the militaries in the Western Union, United States, you got to make, if you're going to get money out of Congress, you got to make the enemy look 10 feet tall. But like the Russians, the Chinese are not 10 feet tall. They're 5'6", armed, heavily armed, and can be quite dangerous. The main advantage the United States has over China right now is economic. The Chinese Communist Party will not continue to rule China if their economy falls apart. Now, it's in danger of falling apart right now. They have a financial crisis somewhat similar, not very, but somewhat similar to the one we created ourselves in 2008. And they're trying to unravel that. Property bubble, bad loans, it all sounds so familiar. But it's done with a Chinese, style, as it were. They are aware of the fact that they could have another revolution, which would chuck them out of power. But most Chinese are aware of the fact that even if there is another revolution, and it can be done at little cost, and most Chinese revolutions tend to be enormously expensive, and these days, with a modern economy, there's a lot more to lose, so not a lot of Chinese are interested in starting another revolution. But if they can replace the Communist Party with something like is in Taiwan or Singapore, Singapore is particularly attractive because that is basically an authoritarian democracy. I mean, it's not a dictatorship. You do have to run for election, but it's like Japan and South Korea to a large extent, where the noble families, as it were, the wealthy, the families with roots in leading, generations, hundreds, centuries, what have you, of leadership and capability, proven capability. They basically play the electoral game and get another one of their people in as the head. Some people say the United States and most other Western democracies are the same thing. Be that as it may, you have to have the assent of the people. That, by the way, is an old Chinese adage. Even when there was an empire, you have to have the assent of the people. That was one of the bases of Confucianism, which is being brought back. Mutual responsibilities. You follow your leader takes care of you. Corruption basically says, hey, I'm paying my taxes, I'm paying off officials, and you're not taking care of me, you're just picking my pockets. So that's where the Chinese are the most vulnerable, and there's really nothing we can do about that. You can't really encourage corruption in China. They need no encouragement. Just let them go. And indeed, in the Pentagon, the old China hands, as it were, the people who read and write China and understand Chinese culture, whenever, their bosses get panic-stricken, they say, hey, let's have coffee, I'll calm you down. And they explain to them how things really work in China. And, of course, they can't tell that this to Congress. But if the Chinese went to war, it would be extremely embarrassing. That's the Chinese feeling. Now, they say that quietly in some of their open publications. Apparently, they say it a lot more in the classified documents. But they are aware of their problems. So they are basically playing around their own, they're taking advantage of, so to speak, of their own defects as well as ours. We have a shrinking defense budget, which is still the largest on the planet. The Chinese still recognizes that our military, man for man, or man for woman, as it were, is superior to whatever the Chinese had. And it's likely to stay that way for, another generation or so. And they take that into account, but they are still moving forward. they are still winning, and it's up to us to basically hang on to what we got, which might be difficult.
Right. Well, Austin, wrap this all up in a nice, tidy bow for us.
I like what Jim said. It's up to us to, when he said, quote unquote, hang on to what we got. There's another slightly different take on that, and I point that out in this week's column. Is the United States would love for China to focus on making money. China focused on making money, getting rich, and not seeing that it does not have to take control of the South China Sea to enjoy the benefits of the South China Sea. Benefits of whether it's natural gas and oil into there. The Vietnamese have told them, hey, help us develop it. Chinese make money, help them do that. They can do that. Filipinos, same kind of deal. And if the Chinese are sitting back there playing the long game, well, then there's a relationship, and they're powerful. They've got an economic stake that could be economic control, but it's also cooperative. It's a collective. Without collective decisions, without coercion, we're not going to a shooting war. May have economic competition, okay? And that's been an inclination of the United States since Deng Xiaoping picked up on. Really, it's Zhou Enlai's is the one who stated it in the 1975 Party Congress. What becomes the Four Modernizations? Jim and I noted that in an early chapter on China in a Quick and Dirty Guide to War series. A lot of people forget that Deng was expanding very astutely and cleverly, and Deng agreed with it too. I mean, he was a promoter of that modernization and liberalization of the economy. But when Deng was doing this, we've encouraged it. Because no reason to be an enemy. Let's accept the economic competition. Let's bring effective contract law to China. That's some of what Jim is getting at in dealing with the corruption issue. There would be some substantial changes to the way China operates if you had effective efficient contract agreements and adjudication of contract disputes instead of going to the third cousin of local sheriff's wife and offering him an iPhone in exchange for help in getting something done. But that's a way of muting or diminishing the prospect of an outright armed conflict. Neither Jim Dunnigan or Austin Bay are advocating that, Dan, and despite some of the little comments we'll see cropping up on strategy page. But what Jim says when holding on to what you got, he means be prepared to defend it. And you read what Carter said. And it is those are very carefully selected words of defending it. Now, the thing is, they're the words. U.S., as Jim pointed out, I like that too, for a generation, maybe more, because we have got an amazing Navy, Dan. We really have an amazing Navy. And got a fabulous Air Force, and we've got some good ideas about modernization and maintaining our edge in these strategic assets. The Chinese know that. They know it. That's one of the reasons they're aggressively trying to steal the technology. So let's leave it at that, and let's come back to this fascinating topic, because it's not going to leave us alone. It's going to keep coming back.
And that's right. All right. We'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
Bye, Dan.
Bye.
Indeed. Bye-bye.